From NPR News, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that gathers the weekend's very best stories and features from All Things Considered. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. This episode, why we're obsessed with the idea that college was a waste, and one man who waited 80 years to get his diploma, why a whole lot of American school children don't know basic history, and a rock-climbing nightmare, a group taken hostage, and what it took to stay alive. Plus, how a 9/11 hate crime victim has become an advocate for his attacker. And finally, music diva Jill Scott talks about how she got into singing. That's on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. Guy Raz is away. I'm Laura Sullivan. Americans are counting their pennies these days, taking a close look at everything from the cost of milk to their mortgage. And that means it's time for the age-old question.
For years, we've been told the surest way to make more money is to invest in yourself by getting a college degree. But with the cost of college rising faster than inflation,
many are now asking,
is college worth the price of admission?
Is college worth the cost?
Is college really
worth it?
Is college really worth it? Or is it the big lie?
College does cost three times as much as it did 30 years ago. But since World War II, a house and a degree has been the American dream, a sign you've made it. In 2009, more than 70% of high school graduates enrolled in college, almost twice as many as in 1960. Could so many people be wrong? That's our cover story today. Why do we continue to question the value of a college diploma?
What you see, if you look at the news stories over time, and really going all the way back to the 1970s when they first started to appear, is that a real formula has emerged over time.
Kevin Carey is policy director for the education sector, an education policy think tank here in Washington, D.C. He could write a college graduate horror story in his sleep.
You start with some kind of very alarming, attention-grabbing headline.
College graduates may be no better equipped for the work world than high school students.
And then you find a recent college graduate in the worst possible circumstances to lead off your story.
Chris Alfred followed the crowd at his high school and went to college and grad school. Now he owes more than $125,000.
The key is to find someone who just graduated from college, who's working in a terrible job.
I work at a call center and I make $10 an hour. And I feel like a loser.
And living in just the most abject circumstances. They're on food stamps. They've moved back in with their parents, much to their parents' alarm.
I'm just about broke and I'm about to graduate. So it's time to pack it up and go back and spend some of my mom and dad's money.
And then from there, you sort of start to broaden the thesis.
Everybody is nervous.
And say something like, people are increasingly questioning whether college is worth it.
A recent survey asked thousands of students at hundreds of colleges, would you go to your school again? About 40% said they would not.
You track down an expert.
The bachelor's degree, it's America's most overrated product.
And then you finish with a quote saying, my life is terrible, I'm in a dead-end job, I'm sad, I'm hungry.
Frankly, I'll take what I can get because right now I need money.
What is to become of me?
We'll get back to Kevin Carey in a minute, but first, one woman's story that sounds pretty familiar from two decades ago. In 1989, Melissa Burke headed out to the University of Florida, even though people told her it might not help her get a job. And when she graduated 4 years later, it was pretty bleak.
There was a lot of kind of static or tension in the air around whether or not we were going to be able to find good jobs that would really set us on our way for careers.
It was the middle of a recession. She started to look for work early.
So my friend and I decided just to head out and see the country and really face the career issue or the lack of jobs or whatever in the fall rather than deal with it right off the bat in May. So when I started looking, there were a lot of resumes sent out and a lack of calls back and a lack of interviews. And I was very aware of the struggle or the perceived struggle in terms of landing that first job and starting off on that career path. You know, I remember hearing the stories. I mean, I was featured in an article that the headline was Grads Without Jobs.
You wouldn't know from that 1993 Washington Post headline that things were about to take a turn for Melissa Burke, which you'll hear in a minute. And that's one of the things that drives Kevin Carey crazy. He's the policy director at the education sector. And when we talked, I asked him, what's so bad about this kind of story?
It's missing a lot of really important long-term trends. If you look at wage data, people with college degrees are making more and more and more money. And basically everyone else is either staying the same or falling back. So the economy has expanded a lot, but basically college graduates are the people who have reaped the benefits of that, and non-college graduates have really struggled to stay ahead.
So, why do we love this storyline so much?
Well, I think the kind of people who read the New York Times and the Washington Post tend to be more college educated. And so this really tweaks their anxieties. If you're a parent and you've spent your whole life trying to get your son or daughter into a good college and spent a lot of money, the last thing you want to hear is that that was a bad idea and they're going to be coming home and they'll be unemployed soon. And so people gravitate towards stories that speak to their fear and their anxieties.
So, I mean, we've heard this story over and over again, this question, is college worth it? But it seems to really have hit a nerve lately. I mean, you have venture capitalist Peter Thiel paying kids to skip college. Why is it taking off so much right now?
We always see a spike in this kind of story during economic downtimes because, of course, when there's a recession, it's harder for everyone to find a job, including college graduates. Although, again, I would note that even in this most recent terrible recession, college graduates were less likely to be unemployed before it started, and they were less likely to lose their jobs after the recession happened. And in fact, only college graduates, they're the only segment of the economy where employment has actually gotten better during the first 5 months of this year. But the other reason I think that there's this level of anxiety is that college is much, much more expensive than it used to be. So when people are wrestling with that cost-benefit equation, the cost part of it has gotten bigger and bigger, and so their sense of how much the benefits ought to be has risen as well.
So what do you say to people who feel like they have just been cheated by the higher education system?
It is possible to be cheated by the higher education system. We've seen a lot of intention in Washington, D.C. over the last year about abuses in the for-profit higher education industry. The Obama administration took action just a couple of weeks ago, in fact, to put in new regulations that would prevent predatory for-profit colleges from inducing students to take out tens of thousands of dollars in loans for degrees that often have little value in the job market. This is not to say that everything is totally fine and that any college will always be worth it, but the long-term trends about the average value of a college degree are very strong.
Is that what the economists say, too?
Economists like to argue with one another, and so there is some dispute in the field about this, but you look at somebody like, for example, there's a labor economist at Georgetown University named Anthony Carnevale who has calculated that on our current pace, we are going to produce 3 million fewer college graduates by 2018 than the economy will demand. That if you look at the new
fewer,
so we're not producing enough right now. And that's because if you look at the fastest growing job categories, they tend to be jobs that require some level of post-secondary education. And we have this continuing phenomenon of old jobs that have been around a long time being redefined upward in terms of the skills that they require. and employers will be looking for those people with degrees.
That's Kevin Carey, policy director of a think tank called the Education Sector. He joined us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you.
Remember Melissa Burke? Well, what Carey said about a college degree paying off in the end was true for her.
So I saw an ad in the paper for a job of desktop publisher secretary. I applied for that job, got it. And I think, you know, for me, it was not my ideal career path. You know, I didn't go to college for 4 years to be a secretary. But I really saw it as an opportunity to start working in the field, you know, that I knew I wanted to be in. I started out, I was supporting the director of membership and communications. And, you know, 5 years later, I had her job. So taking that, you know, initial step of doing a job that maybe I perceived as less than ideal really, you know, was the first step to kind of, you know, starting my career.
Melissa Burke now runs her own HR consulting firm in Silver Spring, Maryland. Although a college degree often leads to financial security, it can be hard to finish in tough economic times. If you do decide to drop out, turns out it's never too late to go back.
My nephew and niece got this thing going. He asked me if I'd be interested in going back to school and getting my license, you might say.
That's Leo Plass. In a few months, he'll be 100 years old. When he decided to go to school for a degree in teaching, the year was 1929.
This was all during the Depression. Things were kind of hard going then.
Plass put his money in the bank, but it went broke, and he couldn't pay the bills. That was when a friend offered him a spot in a logging company, and even though he only had one semester left, Plass dropped out.
I needed the money to live on.
Plass went to work in construction and traveled all over the country.
But I spent probably 25 years down in Yuma, Arizona, where I worked for a contractor down there. Every year, after elk season, we'd go down there and spend the winters up until about April the 1st, and then the Gussahatchee couldn't even hang on to your tools.
Eventually, Plass ended up in Redmond, Oregon, where he still lives and spends his time building birdhouses, picture frames, and chairs for children. So when his nephew showed up and asked if he wanted to get his diploma, he was just a few credits short of his teaching degree. He said,
I'm just too old to do it.
But then he thought it over and decided he wanted a college degree.
I was the first one that went through the line of about 700 of them up there, and which was about 600 more than I figured it would be there. It was really something out of this world, I'll tell you for sure.
He now has something to put in one of those picture frames he makes, a diploma from Eastern Oregon University, 80 years after freshman orientation. This week, in response to a whole lot of different things in the news, I called up my high school history teacher, Mrs. Clark.
So I'm Mrs. Clark still, Laura. Will I be Mrs. Clark forever? It's okay.
I hadn't talked to Mrs. Clark for 20 years, but she remembered me, and I sure remembered her. One of the things I remember so much that you used to do is you used to tell history like a big, dramatic, giant story. You know, that we all got to sort of be on the sidelines of watching. And is that something you did on purpose?
Oh, yes, I think I did. And it's very gratifying to hear you say that. I think a lot of being a history teacher is being really in love with the subject matter.
I call Mrs. Clark, of course, because of the news this week that lesser American history teachers may have something to answer for. Most of their students, a federal study reported, do not know basic historical facts like why Abraham Lincoln is important or what problem Brown versus Board of Education solved. We'll have more from Mrs. Clark in a moment, but first, a line here from an article in the New York Times. It reads, 25% of students do not know that Abraham Lincoln was president during the Civil War. Care to take a guess when that article was published? Here's a hint. It wasn't last week.
Well, it could probably be in 1943.
Diane Ravitch is a historian of education, and she's right. That 1943 article was headlined, Ignorance of U.S. History Shown by College Freshmen. Every 10 years or so, you can find almost that exact same article printed again, like clockwork.
There is currently a narrative in this country of failure and decline. The fact is the schools are not in decline. We have seen fairly dramatic improvement in the reading and math skills of our children since the early 70s.
There are also tests that come out every few years that stack American education up against that of other countries. You say the first test of this kind was issued in the mid-1960s.
Right.
How did we do that?
We came in last. This is ironic, as part of the decline narrative is saying, look at these international test scores. The last one came out this past December. We placed in about the middle. We didn't do that well, but the response was gloom and doom.
And yet it was an improvement.
Well, what they didn't seem to realize was we've never been first in the world in math and science. In the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, we have been in the bottom quartile. So when you hear this declinist rhetoric, we have the biggest economy in the world, the most successful economy in the world, the most productive workers, the most inventors. How could all of this success have come from kids who were in the bottom quartile in the international assessments? It suggests to me that there's no connection.
Education historian Diane Ravitch. So back to my history teacher, Mrs. Clark. It turns out in a few years there will be a national assessment test that may be a bit easier on students than this past week's history test. The same federal testing program is going to test them on techno-literacy, how much they know about computers and technology.
Well, it's actually a brand new assessment.
Steve Schneider is a senior program director at WestEd, the company developing the framework for the new test.
They've had a national assessment for educational progress in art. They've had it in music. They've had it in English language arts. They've had it in mathematics. They've had it in history. And everyone said, what about technological literacy and engineering, since we're into the 21st century and there's a large global demand for our students to be able to compete in these areas?
So we asked Steve Schneider to draw up some sample questions to figure out how a history teacher might do on this new techno-literacy quiz. Mrs. Clark and I took on the challenge.
Trace the evolution of features on an early cell phone compared to current smartphone technologies.
All right, so you're saying how is the early cell phone different than the new cell phone? Mrs. Clark, do you have a cell phone?
Well, believe it or not, I've only had a cell phone for the last like a year and a half.
Okay.
But they were just about phone calls in the past. And now they've got full-on computers in them.
And I also sort of remember that you could talk for about 3 minutes and then it would go dead.
Yes.
Is any of that?
Me true.
What do you think? Are we close?
You guys are on the right track. Would you like the next question?
Yes, we're ready.
Okay, describe a set of troubleshooting steps that would be appropriate for analyzing a problem with a printer.
Nah. Call in the tech guy.
Yeah, that was my number two. A big thanks to Mrs. Clark and Steve Schneider. You can find more sample questions from the new techno-literacy test on our website at npr.org. In 2000, a group of four young rock climbers set out to the Karasu Valley in Kyrgyzstan to climb some of the most spectacular cliffs in the world, until something went very wrong. The four were taken hostage, held for 6 days, and only escaped when they pushed one of their captors off a cliff.
Four American rock climbers are back home safely after escaping from Islamic rebels in Kyrgyzstan.
That's NPR's Noah Adams back in 2000. The photographer on that trip was John Dickey, and in a few weeks he's planning to return to Kyrgyzstan to climb again. And that's got him thinking about how it all went down 11 years ago.
Well, the plan was to get dropped off in the Karasu Valley. That all went perfectly according to plan, and Tommy and Beth finally picked out a line.
Tommy and Beth are two of your companions that are with you.
Yes, and we decided to head up on this formation, and that night was actually Tommy's 21st birthday, and we kind of had a small little celebration.
Up on the rock?
Exactly, a little freeze-dried apple cobbler, I believe it was, something like that, and went to bed.
And when did things start to go wrong?
At dawn the next morning. We heard a ping, which immediately, you know, when you're up on a wall sleeping in the portal edge, the first thing you think is rock fall. But it wasn't. Another ping, and that really sounded like a gunshot. You look down, and there's guys on the ground waving you down, and then there was a third shot, and it was clear that they wanted us to come on down.
I have a piece of tape from that report back in 2000, and here's your colleague, Beth Rodden, describing when the militants started firing.
At first, when the first two shots were fired, we thought maybe there's hunters with bad aim or something, but then when the third one came,
right.
And sand landed on our sleeping bags, we knew that it was for us. And our equipment.
Tell me about that moment.
That moment, you know, it was very surreal, I would have to say. I go to the ground, shook hands, and they were, you know, very clear about how the others come down now.
And these militants took you into their custody, and they marched you into a valley where you ran into a firefight with the Kyrgyzstan army. What was that battle like?
Crazy, strange, wild, violent. There really wasn't any time to have any emotional reaction to, oh, look, here's a body that's been executed. All you could really think to yourself is, it's in these rebels' best interest that they keep us alive as hostages. So let's just run with that for now.
What was the moment that you knew that you had to make a run for it?
It wasn't until the sixth day, until all four of us finally agreed that we need to do something about this. And here is this opportunity where we have two rebels with us, and we're going to be left with the one very naive, inexperienced kid to climb up this humongous ridgeline for what the four of us is extremely easy terrain, but for him was very dangerous and difficult terrain. Instantaneously, Tommy handled the situation, grabbed the gentleman by the gun strap over his shoulder, and just threw him straight off the cliff.
And then, as it turns out, the militant actually survived the fall. And this was a while later that you guys went back and spoke to him. How
yes,
did that happen?
The following season, Jason and I went back with Greg Child, who was writing a book about the story. It came out that if you want, you can go to the prison and interview this guy. And we sat down with him and chatted.
What did you talk about with him?
You know, I asked him if his mother knew where he was.
So now you are returning to Kyrgyzstan to climb again. Why are you going back?
Well, that whole region holds some of the great prizes in climbing. I mean, there's a reason we went in the first place, and we didn't get to have our trip. And I've always wanted to go back. I want to go have this climbing trip.
Is there any part of you that's also a little bit scared?
Of course, there will definitely be a strong stroll down memory lane, and I can't predict how I'm going to react.
Will you do anything differently this time?
You know, there is nothing else we could have done to prevent what happened to us on the first trip. You can build a house and put in the greatest sprinkler system ever, but that does not guarantee that your house could not burn down someday, and that's just life.
John Dickey is a photographer and rock climber who's returning to Kyrgyzstan later this summer. John, thanks so much for coming in, and be safe out there.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
We When Race Bouillon was in his mid-20s, he thought he hit the jackpot. He was living in Bangladesh and had put his name in an annual U.S. State Department visa lottery, and he won. He moved to Dallas, Texas, enrolled in school, took a job at a mini-mart. He thought it was the beginning of a new life. Then, 10 days after 9/11, a man named Mark Stroman walked into the store and shot him in the face with a double-barreled shotgun. It was part of a spree that left two other Muslim men dead. Now, the state of Texas says it's Mark Stroman's turn to die, in a few weeks, by lethal injection. But there's a twist. Race Bouillon is now fighting to save the life of the man who tried to take his. Race Bouillon joins us now from Dallas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Describe for me what happened on Friday, September 21st, 2001.
I was working in a gas station. One gunman entered the store, and he came to the station with a gun pointing towards me. I opened the cash register and offered him the cash and requested him not to shoot me and take the money. In reply, he asked me, "Where are you from?" And the question seemed strange to ask during a robbery, and I said, "Excuse me." And as soon as I spoke, I felt the sensation of a million bees stinging my face, and then heard an explosion. Images of my mother, my father, other siblings, and my fiancé appeared before my eyes. I did not know if I was still alive. I looked down at the floor and saw blood was pouring like an open faucet from the right side of my head. And I placed both my hands on my face, thinking that I have to keep my brain from spilling out. And I remember I heard myself screaming, "Mom." I was crying and I was asking God, "Give me a second chance. I don't want to die today. And I promise if you give me a second chance, I will dedicate my life for others, and I will do the best I can." I was reciting from Quran, all the verses I have memorized in my childhood. I was reciting very fast, and I was asking God, "Please give me a chance, please."
You were shot in the right side of your face, and you were left nearly blind by the bullets. What was the recovery process like? How many surgeries did you have?
Well, I had to go through several surgeries. And finally, the doctor could save the eye, but the vision is gone. And I'm still carrying more than 35 pellets on the right side of my face. Once I touch my face, my skull, I can feel it's all bumpy. It took several years to go through all these painful surgeries, one after another one.
Was it hard when you think about what had happened and how traumatic this was for you and your family? How did you find a sense of forgiveness for the man that shot you?
According to my faith in Islam, there is no hate, no killing. It doesn't allow anything like that. Yes, Mark Stroman did a horrible thing, and he brought a lot of pain and disaster, sufferings in my life. But in return, I never hated him, and by hating him, it's not going to bring any good solution to the society, but if he's forgiven, who knows?
And now you're trying to save his life.
God will save his life. I'm just doing my part the best I can, because I strongly believe executing him is not a solution. We will just simply lose a human life without dealing with the root cause, which is hate crime.
I'm wondering if you think about the idea that Stroman targeted you because you're Muslim, yet it's your faith that's propelling you to try to save his life in many ways. Do you see it that way?
The Islamic principle, the Islamic teaching is that there is no hate, no killing. Because in Islam it says saving one human life is the same as saving the entire mankind. Since I forgave him, all those principles encouraged me to go even more farther and stop this execution and save another human life.
I spoke with Mark Stroman's attorney to see if Stroman was aware that you were trying to save his life. And she said that when she first told him, he broke down crying. And he said, "This is the first act of kindness that I've ever known." She also said that he wants you to know that he is deeply and truly sorry.
How do you feel about that?
There is no doubt about he did a heinous crime. Mentally, he died many times. He is just there to die physically through this execution. I strongly believe he only took his lesson and he changed his heart, and it just brings tears in my eyes.
That's Reyes Bouillon, who was shot at point-blank range 2 weeks after 9/11 and is now fighting to save the life of the man who tried to kill him. Reyes, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. It is my pleasure to be here today.
I'm Laura Sullivan, and I'm standing here at the Capitol Hill Flea Market in Washington, D.C., and I'm here with someone who really knows a lot about this kind of place. Her name is Maureen Stanton, and she's written a book called Killer Stuff and Tons of Money, Seeking History and Hidden Gems in Flea Market America, and we're going to see if we can find some of those hidden gems today. And we should say that we're taping this first thing in the morning. We're here pretty early, but we're already late. I mean, really, this is late.
This is late. For a flea market that opens to the public at 8 o'clock, the dealers are here sometimes right at the crack of dawn when the light's out unpacking, and they're trading amongst each other. I mean, the antique dealers generally are picking the other tables. They call it picking the field or picking the tables, looking for the thing that they can resell for, you know, double or triple or tenfold.
One of the things that really came out in your book is that this going on here is an entire subculture to itself. I mean, these are people that are traveling the majority of the year. They're up, you know, they work 80 to 100 hours a week. They have to sell, they have to buy constantly. And there's it's got its own kind of underground kind of culture going on.
And there is. There's a, just like any subculture, there's a language and there's a knowledge base. Some antique dealers just, they have shops, but they'll come out and do big shows several times a year.
The main character in your book, who's you give the name of Kurt Avery to, Kurt Avery was able to run through the flea market. He would get there first thing in the morning, I mean, hours before anybody else even showed up. And he would be able to run through in 15, 20 minutes, just pick exactly the items that could resell, $5 item for $100, in some cases $100 or $200 item that he resold for thousands of dollars. And he makes it look really easy, like, oh, we can all just show up and go grab these items. But it's actually not easy at all. I mean, how would you describe his job?
Well, he's at this point now where he has developed this knowledge. So I call it his antique laser vision lens. And he can look at a batch of things and he can find the thing that's valuable. He can tell right away. But it's taken him 15 to 20 years to get there. And he has a house full of mistakes, as he'll say. You buy the thing and you take it to someone who's more knowledgeable. You say, check this out. What do you think? And the person will say, well, that's a repro. That's not real. Or this is cracked. Or this isn't the one you want because it's not the right form or the right color.
How much do you think Kurt Avery makes every year?
It probably varies, but he's probably making, you know, maybe, say, $80,000, something like that.
I mean, that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, but don't forget he has to pay for the objects, or there's the cost of the objects, and sometimes he's making 10 times what he paid. Sometimes it's just double, you know.
And, of course, there's the hours. I mean, he was on the road three-quarters of the year. I mean, he was sleeping in his car, sleeping in a tent. Yeah. You know, he was working 80 to 120 hours a week.
He's really driven. He's driven both by just his ethic of, you know, workaholic kind of thing, but he's also driven by the passion. And, you know, when you think about it, that if you have that knowledge now, that you might find that thing worth 50 or 100 or even more, I think that, you know, you want to be out there looking because that could be the day.
In one case, he did walk by a really, really great item four or five times in the day.
And that was a shaker piece. It was a yarn winder. The shakers used to make their own yarn out of fleece.
And we should say that the shakers were an 18th century religious sect that made some really exquisite furniture.
Furniture and, you know, many objects. And so he walked by this yarn winder four or five times, and many other knowing dealers, very knowledgeable dealers, walked by it. And he eventually looked at it a little closer for a minute, thought, it looks good. It has nice paint. I might be able to get $300 for it. That was priced at $90. When he looked at it closer a little bit later, he thought, this looks like it could be a Shaker-made object. So he discerned that it was Shaker, and he brought it to an auction, a specialty Shaker auction, and he was able to sell it for $6,500. So for $90, it's a good profit, but to make a living, you've got to do that 20 times a year. And so that knowledge paid off. Shaker objects go for hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So I'm talking to Maureen Stanton, author of Killer Stuff and Tons of Money, and we're here at the Capitol Hill Flea Market. Let's go talk to this guy, because he looks sort of interesting. What is your name?
My name is Jim Tam.
Jim Tam.
But I'm called the Map Man. That was the name given me by the people who came by.
It looks like you have hundreds? Thousands?
Here I have probably hundreds, yeah.
Hundreds of maps,
yes,
here in,
yeah,
this booth. Well, this is Maureen Stanton. She wrote a book about how to shop at flea markets and,
oh, wow,
sort of the culture of flea markets and,
oh,
the passion for the old items.
Oh.
And this is sort of exactly what she was writing about.
Oh,
is,
yeah,
this? You have a passion for these maps.
I would do this anyway. I would be doing this in my front lawn probably. Sadly. But, no, I'm one of these people that had boxes of things floor to ceiling before I did this. People like that need a store, okay? That's the answer. So I now have my little store.
Maureen, you talked about this occupational hazard,
yeah,
that a lot of dealers have. What did you find?
Well, I found that a lot of people get into the business because they're supporting their own habit.
Yes.
And so they'll sell other things they don't want or lesser things as they move up the ranks and their objects that they collect. But it's a passion. But I feel like the collectors and the antique dealers are each their little curators, preserving a little part of American culture and history.
Maureen Stanton, author of Killer Stuff and Tons of Money, and you can find all of her tips on how to shop at flea markets at npr.org. Maureen, thank you so much for coming out shopping with us today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to go to a flea market.
When Jill Scott came on the music scene a little more than a decade ago, she wanted to let the world know just who is Jill Scott. That, in fact, was the title of her debut album. He let you go a long time ago, now it's time to turn him loose. Let's take a long walk. Since then, the Philadelphia native has won 3 Grammys, sold 5 million records, and starred in a number of movies and TV shows, from the film Why Did I Get Married to the HBO series The Number One Ladies Detective Agency. Now Jill Scott is back in the music mix with a new album coming out Tuesday. It's called The Light of the Sun, and we caught up with her in her hometown at member station WRTI on the campus of Temple University.
I went here for about 3 years. I was going to teach the wonders of the English language to high school students, 11th grade.
Why'd you change your mind?
I had a principal tell me that I was young and idealistic and that I would get over it. You know, everything about the school was gray. And I said, you guys, you have to understand, these are kids, you know, and they walk in the door and everything is gray. It feels like they're already defeated. I know I feel defeated walking in. We have to get some color on the walls. And that's when the principal told me I was young and idealistic and that I would get over it.
Ooh.
And I was like, okay, you know what? I won't.
And you walked out and ended up in music. How did,
yep,
that happen?
It started off with poetry. I was reading poetry to my girlfriends, and they were like, you're really good. You should go to some poetry readings or something. And I eventually went and got somewhat of a name for myself and a little bit of a following. And one day I just got up to read a poem and started singing. I looked around. The reaction was great. And I said, oh, boy, I like this. Let's see if I could do some more of this.
And now here you are with your new album, Light of the Sun.
Yes.
Let's listen to the first track of this album called Blessed.
This is the last take for the night. Understand it's kind of late. And I gotta get home to my son. Cause he's so special to me. I mean, I gotta see him. I need to breathe him. That's my baby. Don't call me crazy. I love the studio, but I love him more. Let me give you what I got, so.
Jill Scott, this is a song very much about your own life. How do you figure,
yes,
out how much to reveal in your music and how much to hide?
Well, I don't really hide, but I do keep some things to myself. Not everything is up for conversation. Not everything is up for art. But do I really discern what is and what's not? That's the question. Most of the time, particularly with this record, The Light of the Sun, I've really just been standing in front of a microphone and blacking out musically. You know, I come back a couple hours later and there's six songs from beginning to end. You know, I don't know what I'm going to say. I don't know how I'm going to say it. I don't even know what the musicians are going to play, nor do they. You know, it's just been happening that way. It's like we're taking musical journeys.
Woke up this morning listening to this song. You're so blessed. Yes, yes. Gonna rock this joint all night long. You're so blessed. Yes.
This energy and these lyrics and truth and vulnerability and power and passion and all this stuff is pouring out. I don't judge it. I don't beat it up, and I don't question it either. You know, if it's here, it's for a reason. If it's coming out the way it is, it's for a reason. And that's pretty much the way I look at it. You know, I think about Miles Davis saying that there's no mistakes in music. You know, there's no wrong note. And I kind of live by that.
Where does your inspiration come from?
My mother is a genius. She just kept feeding me art on whatever we had, paper plate, silver platter, didn't matter. You know, she just kept feeding it to me. So we went to see all kinds of theater. We would go to the art museum pretty much every Sunday, and I would watch her. She let me know that art was supposed to touch. You know, some paintings, she would cry, you know, standing in front of a painting. I didn't know why, but it touched her. She really just gave me the freedom to appreciate art and to be artistic.
I'm speaking with singer, poet, and actress Jill Scott about her new album, The Light of the Sun. You've taken on a number of different, very memorable film and TV roles in a very short period. One of them was in the ensemble cast of Tyler Perry's Why Did I Get Married? And you played Sheila, a pretty passive wife who took a lot of psychological abuse from her husband, a husband she later finds out is cheating.
I thought that God had given up on me. Because here I am in this marriage and it don't work. He don't love me. He don't like me.
This was a very real, very raw character. How did you get there?
For me, it's all about the writing first. And then I look into this character and create her. You know, all the little nuances, how she walks, how she sits, if she stands with a bowed head. I looked at the way Sheila was being treated. And I hurt for her, so that allowed me to hurt being her.
Sheila actually reminds me a little bit of the song Hear My Call, number 7 on your new album, The Light of the Sun.
I am such a fool. How did I get here? Play by all the rules, then they changed. I am but a child to your vision. Standing in the cold and the rain, lost here in the dark, I can't see my foot to take a step. What is happening? All this hurts so bad, I can hardly breathe. I just want to leave. So, God,
it's such a beautiful song. It's so raw. It sounds so theatrical almost. Is that what you were going for?
Yeah, it does. Even when I listen to it, it makes me get quiet. It is meant to be theatrical. Emotion is supposed to be evoked. It's music.
God, please hear my call. I am afraid for me.
It's so human, you know? And I know I'm not the only one who's ever felt lost and confused by a broken heart. You know, it's actually very difficult for me to sing live because I have to embody those things in order to give permission to everyone else in the audience to feel something, mm-hmm. You know. So here's free music with some flaws, some mistakes that I wouldn't touch if you paid me. I would not auto-tune a thing. I wouldn't do it.
Do you play an instrument of any kind?
I do not.
How do you put the music to the words?
Well, I have a great team of musicians that are, they blow me away. I normally give them the beat with my mouth. I normally give them the notes, and then I describe the textures. So I'll tell them it's in the South, it's hot, there's mosquitoes everywhere, but you can't, there's mosquitoes, and you're drinking corn liquor to keep the mosquitoes away. And your favorite woman, not your only woman, your favorite woman has decided that she's going to marry somebody else. Now play.
What would the bass line for that sound like?
I would say really guttural. Something to that effect. And then I would tell the drummer that the snare is, it's on fire and you just need to fan it. So you've got the dun 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 dun, and then the ching sh sh ching sh sh ching sh, you know, and then it starts to happen. It's more like we're communicating with each other and painting a picture that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then I come in and I lay whatever lines are on my mind, and then we've got this moment, and it's music, and it's alive, and it's happening now.
I want to play another track from the CD. This is called Womanifesto.
I am not going to lie and pacify. I am arms to hold. I am lips to speak. I am a motherfucking G. Strong legs that stroll off the 33 bus or out of a money green phantom comfortably. Knees that bend to pray, clean from Ajax washings. Hair that is thick and soft. Thighs that betwixt an amazing all-expense grand prize. I am eyes that sing.
Not many singers put a poem on their new R&B album. Why did you do it?
I had been looking around and noticing that women were really compartmentalizing themselves as well as allowing society to, you know, pull apart our pieces. And I, you know, it frustrates me because what were we fighting for? Equal pay is one thing, but there's the whole of a woman, you know, whole of a person, and that has to be respected as well. It's not just her eyes or her breast or her booty or whatever. I mean, there's an all of you, and that is my womanifesto, and I would hope that other women would write theirs. You know, just to value the rest of you is massive. And it's, for me, it's been life-altering.
Jill, thanks so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
I'm the one you really want, but you just can't see it. I tried and tried to make you understand, won't believe it.
That's Jill Scott's latest single, Shame, from her new album, The Light of the Sun. It comes out Tuesday, but until then, you can sample every track from the record at our website, nprmusic.org.
You can't see a damn thing. Uh-huh. Well, what you so scared of me for? I'm just a woman. Maybe I got it all together like you think. Maybe I do.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program is directed by Brent Bachman and produced by Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Sarah Gonzalez, Sammy Yenigan, and Sarah Ventry. Our intern is Kevin Lasky. Rick Holter is the senior editor, and our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Laura Sullivan. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays.
You're missing out on me. And it's a shame.